You're listening to the Art House Cinema Podcast, looking at art house films released in London in August 2007. I'm Alex Fitch, and I'm joined in this edition by Kim Morgan and Virginie Selavi. On the 3rd of August, Eye for India was released at the ICA. In the 1950s, economical filmmakers such as Ed Wood and Terry Morse could fashion entire narratives out of found footage to fill drive-in double bills. As film stock and cameras became cheaper, the amateur filmmaker could shoot home movies and commit transitory life experiences to celluloid and later home video. Combining these two traditions, as we find ourselves comfortably in the second century of cinema, there are now stacks of footage for low-budget documentarians to forage within, finding more homespun narratives to fill the silver screen. Following 2003's acclaimed Tarnation, in which American filmmaker Jonathan Cowett turned home movies of his formative years into an introspective psychological examination of his own life, a British director has now collated and edited her family's history into an engaging tale of a bifurcated family separated by land and culture. In 1965, Yash Pal Suri emigrated to Britain with his wife and daughters from India. A doctor by profession and amateur filmmaker by hobby, he shot films of life in the UK, which he sent to his family back home. He also sent his relatives their own camera, projector, and film stock so that they could reply in kind, and so began a 40-year dialogue between the two, documenting family and social change in two continents. The film is mainly made up of juxtaposed pieces of footage from either side of the family, and shows charming footage of both the UK and India from over the years. Combined with letters, contemporary music, and recorded diary entries to go with the silent footage, this is a bittersweet tale that shows a family that longs for their missing members to be returned to them, and conversely, a nuclear family in the UK who find it increasingly difficult to return to their roots. Director Sanjay Suri deftly cuts together a mountain of these home movies, along with recently shot footage of her retired parents, as well as documentary excerpts from sources such as the BBC that show a patronising attitude to this country's new arrivals in post-war Britain, including a shocking scene where a presenter demonstrates the use of a light switch. You press here, and the light goes on. This then has a poignant echo when the director's mother goes to a modern-day presentation at her local social club, where a member gives an illustrated lecture on his experiences in India. Determined to be absent from the film herself except in older footage, and as the unseen eye behind the camera, Suri avoids the mawkish emotions and forced hilarity jaded viewers may have come to expect from home movie extracts which have been shown on ITV, and has ended up constructing a moving and poignant tale of cultural attitudes and the literal and geographical bereavement of families torn apart by opportunities in new lives and new homes. I'm talking to Sanjay Suri, the director of Eye for India, which is showing at the ICA this month. I suppose the most obvious question to start with is, when did you decide to take your family's footage and turn it into a feature?
Well, I decided to take the footage and turn it into a feature when I got hold of the tapes, the audio tapes. I discovered a box of old tapes. There had been Super 8 films that I used to watch as well that I knew of, but it was the discovery of the tapes which really showed 40 years of recordings on both sides from my father in England and his relatives back in India, and this exchange of audio letters and films. So when I realised that I had such a long span of material, I absolutely had to make the film.
Cool. What's your what was your filmmaking education?
I studied at the National Film and Television School, and I studied documentary, and I was lucky enough to get this first feature financed directly out of film school, so that process was quite quick. Making it took a bit longer.
And presumably the Super 8 films were silent before that, and adding the sound kind of made it more real in a way.
Well, sometimes my father did two things. Sometimes he'd send the Super 8 reels and the audio reels separately, and sometimes we'd, as a family, with the children as well, would combine and put our own soundtracks on them, which is why there's some very dodgy 70s music all over the place. So we'd sometimes add commentary and sometimes send separately.
Because I did wonder, when there's footage of, say, travelling on a train or going to the beach, was that Foley sound that you recorded separately for the movie, or was it recorded at the time?
Some of it is recorded at the time, and for example, one thing that my father did a lot was soundtracks. He really loved putting the music that he felt was atmospheric. So when he shot all these pictures of snow, he took the music from Dr. Zhivago and thought it would really add to the drama when he sent the tape to India.
I suppose, as you're a filmmaker, was it growing up in that environment that sort of encouraged you, or is it something you came to on your own?
Well, my sisters have both got very sensible jobs, so maybe I was influenced. I think the thing that my father taught me most was the importance of documenting as opposed to cinema. It was the fact that he constantly documented and chronicled everything. That's why my entry into film was via documentary as opposed to fiction.
When you look at the kind of Indian films that are available to the general public in this country, I suppose it's fairly earnest stuff like Satyajit Ray's Apu trilogy, Mehta's Fire, Earth and Water, which was completed recently. And then in contrast, there's a whole Bollywood thing. I mean, do you think that perhaps with your film, because you're linking both British culture and Indian culture, it's kind of creating the dialogue that's in the footage for the film audience as well?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think there's space for for Indian documentaries as well. First of all, I really wish people would come and see more, because there's some really great documentaries out there. And there's a lot of interesting things happening in Indian cinema. I think there's been a tendency to take a good look at the Bollywood culture and the kitsch and the funny and to focus on that. But there's a lot more behind all of that, of course.
There are political elements to your film. You add footage of the National Front and some fairly antiquated footage of, I think it was the BBC, talking about welcoming visitors to the country. How much did you feel you ought to add that kind of narrative that's sort of absent from the home movies?
Well, it was a really, really difficult process actually during the editing, because at some stage myself and my editor felt that we were really disrupting the flow with the Super 8 by bringing in this archive. But at the same time, it was really clear to me that the film had to have a bigger feel about it as opposed to just my family's story. And there were things in the archive that my family archive that were missing, but the content that were implied but needed to be reinforced through the archive. So I felt it was really important to give that overall picture. And it also, you know, the film has a lot of different textures and a lot of different colors and types of medium, Super 8 and Digibeta and old archive. So I think it added to that texture as well.
I mean, it's interesting as well that the first footage that your father shot of Britain is in black and white, and then the first colour footage you see is of India, which is almost what people expect when they see films from that period.
Exactly. I don't know. He was going through an experimental phase with black and white when he arrived. I think it was a snow thing. He thought it would be best to send that back, but he always sent them colour. I think he wanted to see India in colour. He would have been terribly disappointed to get black and white India back when he was feeling homesick.
And he's still making films now, because you open with him taking footage of Egypt to the local camcorder club. I'm surprised that at that point he's actually asking for advice on how to have it edited after a lifetime's worth of making films.
Well, like every good filmmaker, he's always learning. but also, now that, especially with the release of the film, and now that I've been to film school and I've taken up filming more, I think he's also getting a lot older. He's in his mid-70s now. It's getting a bit difficult. He's filming less and less, but he still does, when he goes on holidays or major events, he still will film.
Some of the attitudes in your film that's shown between the Indians who moved to this country and the locals that are particularly aggressive back in the 70s, there's still an undercurrent of that now when you show your mother attending that meeting where there's some haughty guy talking about his experiences of India, and it seems just as patronising as some of the stuff from the 50s. Did you want to kind of introduce the theme that's still prevalent today in certain circles of society?
No, actually, not at all. With that scene, you see, I view this scene quite neutrally. For me, it's more of a surreal situation that my mother is part of this club where with a lot of elderly white ladies. And she was genuinely interested in going to see this man talk about India, because there's not that many opportunities, you know, to of course there's Indian television and things, but she still welcomes those opportunities to with any link to India. And actually, although his words were could be construed as a little bit condescending, they were also very true in many respects. And he did end on a very important note about how hospitable the Indians had been when he'd been and travelled, and how he wondered if Indians arriving in England, in his town, his village, would get the same reception. So I think he sent out very mixed messages, and it's a, I just want people to watch and come to their own conclusions about them.
There seems to be a renaissance in documentaries made from found footage. I mean, recently there was the American film Tarnation that came out. Because the last couple of generations have been sort of obsessively recording themselves, now on video and back then on Super 8, do you think there are hundreds of narratives out there are still waiting to be told from the mountains of footage?
I pity the poor young poor young people of you know, of this generation, who are going to have to go and deal with, you know, 8,000 hours of birthdays and weddings and all that stuff. Because what was easy for me was that the Super 8 footage, you know, it's 3 minutes of film, so you have to decide, you have to be very conscious about what you're filming, why you're filming it. Whereas I think, you know, with home videos now, it's a lot of tendency to just film for hours, and tapes are cheap. So it's not the footage that makes the story. It's the story. It's the story that counts. So.
I mean, I suppose also it's the period of time that's elapsed, because there's a film about London that was made in the 50s that's, I think it's narrated by James Mason, and then there's a sort of thematic follow-up that was made recently by St. Etienne, and the more recent entry just doesn't have any kind of resonance because you can just go out in the streets and see that. So maybe it's like the interest that people have now with silent footage of Edwardian people, that maybe 50 years down the line, people start looking at all this camcorder footage from the 90s and think, oh, that's how they lived back then.
Exactly, yeah. And even, you know, even now I'm conscious of that. I'm very keen, even though I'm very bad at it because it's my job as well now, but I'm very keen to keep recording little fragments of my life so that I can add to this whole, you know, mountain of footage that we have that I've been able to make into a film.
Self-consciously, you seem to edit yourself out of the film. For example, when you're talking on the webcam with your sister, it's sort of your face is obscured by your camera. I mean, did you just want to sort of like have the camera itself portray you as the sort of the narrator?
Yeah, well, for me, it was actually very important that there not be too many narrators in the film. And for me, the strength in the film is the immediacy of listening to the audio archive of my father in particular speaking, and the ability of that archive to help you connect with him, because it's very intimate audio archive recordings. Mm. So for me, having a, you know, another layer in between of me as the somebody guiding you through the film explicit manner, that wouldn't have been very helpful. I felt that would have diminished the emotional strength of the film, which is why I kept a backseat. But I'm referred to, and you know that the daughter's making the film, and I think I hope there's an intimacy in the shooting and in the storytelling that people generally seem to feel, you know, that there is a daughter who's made this film, and you can feel the love and the tenderness in it without my being present.
What project are you working on next?
A little bit early to say, but I'm working on a couple of projects. I've got a couple of documentaries in development, and you know, these are long, long-term things that take a long time to get funded and to get going, but I'm working on two new projects.
Okay, I think that'll do nicely.
Wonderful.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Eye for India is still playing at the ICA in London, with its final performance on the 6th of September. The first of this month's films that Kim saw was Transylvania, released on the 10th of August.
Well, one of the best things about going to see this film was that I had no idea what I was going to see. So, well, some of the most fun experiences I've had going to the cinema watching a film, I mean, when somebody's given me a ticket or asked me to go along with them, and I've had no idea what it's about. And I thought this was about club music in Transylvania, so I was actually expecting to sort of go through nightclubs and have hippity-hoppity music of some kind, or, you know, Snoop Snoopy Doggy Dog or something like that. And so I was just bemoaning the fact I'd forgotten my earplugs. But I was looking forward to it, thinking, well, it's got the ICA, it's got to be great. And I was just stunned when it started. And it was really... It was just full of folk music, a wide variety, sort of jazzy folk and gypsy folk music, and a real variety of things. And it started off, it was quite a touching love story, which all went horribly wrong. It's the kind of ground which has been treaded an awful lot of times. French cinema does it very, very well. French cinema does it fantastically, and English cinema's done it certainly to some extent, and Hollywood's done it really schmaltzily and badly and given us some really terrible dirge, which, you know, would really be better hadn't been made. But it shouldn't have worked for a number of reasons, because it was quite drab in parts. You know, it's and I'll come back to this when the other film that I saw I'm going to talk about, which was, it's kind of like the end of the world. It's Outpost. And so if at first you think, oh, it might be a bit dull and worthy, but it's really gripping, it's really engrossing. The characters in it are so fully formed and so intriguing. And the way that I kind of rationalised it, the way that I felt about it, is every moment in it and every scenario is believable. Something like that has happened to you, or you know someone that it's happened to. And this is like a movie of a string of those back to back, which is probably one of the best ways to do a movie, which everything's believable and all the reactions are believable. It never happened to one person, or very surprisingly to what happened to one person, and if it did, it would make the most fantastic story, which it does, and it's well done. But it's really touching the way that it's so... Normally, and if you think of a film that's filmed in somewhere like Transylvania, which is quite far away from what we know, the roads, the quality of the roads, the quality of the rail tracks, everything about the living standard is so much, what we think, so much less sophisticated. Actually, it's stunningly beautiful. Sometimes you look at urban decay, and when it's well filmed, it actually looks quite beautiful and stunning, and it makes you step back and look at what's around you. And this does it to that environment. And I have read some criticism about how it misrepresents people from this area, and I think what it does is it shows people really touching moments of honesty and lots of absurdity and lots of strange humour. And there are certain points which is just. I just remember really well. There's one point where the lead character, I can't remember the names because they're foreign. I don't remember things very well. I'm getting to that age in my life. It's my birthday tomorrow, and I'm going to remember even less then. But the main protagonist in the film, she's overall absolutely distraught, and it's everyone can empathise with. When you know, we've all had our romantic notions dashed against the rocks, but hers are burst. And it's an explosion of emotion. It's just shattering, life-destroying. And she just opens the car door, screaming, stop, stop, let me out. And just runs through a forest. And it's a film. It's a scene we've seen in so many films, done in so many ways. And yet in this one, I was absolutely with her. She ran through this forest and through these leaves and just hurled herself to the floor and started crawling herself into a fetal position. And I was like, yeah, we've been there. Most of us sort of lost our... notions as we've gone along through life and they've been taken from us, but hers are ripped from her and it's all a big explosion. That's what makes it cinematic and so gripping. But the characters are great in it, and there are scenes which are just stunning. I would never have thought that I would have enjoyed a film like this, and I was absolutely, everything that happened next was just an eye-opener and mind-blower. And I really have to say, if you get the chance to see it, go see it. And it's a great date movie as well. It's it is about relationships and about us and about the journeys we go through, and it just, you'll never see a film which goes to this part of the world. It's just, do it.
Oh, and isn't about vampires.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, at least I made the misapprehension of thinking it was about club music. Oh, and by the way, the music and the festivals. And that's the other thing about in this film, is that there's a great deal of joy and fun, and I've always maintained the films that I think are best are films that are very often very dark, but very human. And that's what this film really had for me, is there was so much humanity. The characters are so warm and generous. You know, for example, I'll paint a picture for you. There's a scene where a character buys the chandelier. He buys and sells things. And he buys a chandelier. And then he comes along with a large stick. And you can't work out what's going on. And it's all outdoors. And he opens the back of his Mercedes and comes along with a large stick and some wire. And hangs these wires on overhead cables. And he's sat in a field under a tree with a chandelier as he cooks food on an open fire. And the way it's presented, this is no fuss about it. It's just...
It's what they do in Transylvania.
Well, I don't think it's what they do in Transylvania. It's what they do in this film. And that's what makes it so wonderful, is that just these moments. There's another where he bursts into a room to ask to ask these people where the girl is. And there are these two old women, I think one of them's blind, just sitting on this sofa, hitting these what look like homemade double basses, homemade from cardboard and sticky glue and plastic, and they just look like toy things. Huge, great big things, the size of double basses, just hitting them repeatedly with sticks, going boing, 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 boing. It's like
a live-action version of Belleville Rendezvous.
Well, yes, but more like the terrible music in that, but more absurd and stranger. And they just tell them to go away because they're busy. I'm just thinking, what are they doing? These crazy, wonderful people. They're just mad. And yet, really intriguing. There's actually depth and richness to the character, which I don't think you get to see in a lot of films, where you see these people. You know how in certain films, a couple of words are said, a couple of actions are made, and suddenly you know everything about that character. And that's what these people really seem to do an awful lot of.
Transylvania was released on the 10th of August and showed at the Renoir, the Ritzy and Key cinemas around the UK.
1208 East of Bucharest released on August 17th. At 12:08 p.m. on December 22nd, 1989, the Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceaușescu fled the capital city of Bucharest in the face of overwhelming protests against his authoritarian regime. That moment is heralded as the collapse of communism in the Eastern Bloc country and the beginning of an uncertain transition towards democracy. 1208 East of Bucharest is a sparsely elegant, humorous film that reflects on those events 16 years on. As the snow falls lightly across the desolate streets in a small town in eastern Romania, three men prepare to commemorate the anniversary of that fateful day. Iedorescu is something of a local celebrity. A presenter and owner of the small local television station, he's struggling to find guests willing to come on his talk show to discuss their recollections of the revolution. Mănescu, one of the guests, wakes up hungover, his memory of the night before erased, to a call from Iedorescu reminding him about the show. He is a drunk, a history professor who carries around a bottle of booze in his briefcase and is in debt to what seems like the entire town. The other last-minute guest, Old Man Piscocchi, is a lonely widower known for playing Santa Claus at Christmas. Iedorescu's talk show turns into an awkward, painfully comedic disaster. The topic up for discussion is whether or not there was a revolution in this obscure, modest town, or whether people merely took to the streets after 1208 to celebrate Ceaușescu's flight. The film's Romanian title translates as Was There or Wasn't There? Mănescu insists that he was present in the town square before 1208 on that day in 1989, and that he and a small band of colleagues, now all dead, played a small but essential part in the protests that toppled the communist regime. Irate townspeople who call into the show contradict his version of events. A drunk now, he was a drunk then, and could never have taken part in such a momentous event. Insulted, Mănescu clings to his story, desperate to believe that, once in his life, he performed a heroic act. Piscocchi seems unconcerned with the debate, contenting himself with making origami sailboats. Full of regret over the loss of his wife, he has little interest in portraying himself as a hero. Ultimately, the acrimonious debate is inconclusive. Shot in muted tones of brown and khaki, the film evokes not nostalgia, but the impression that little has changed in the years following the victory of the pro-democratic movement. The town itself is drab and barren. Ugly concrete apartment blocks line the treeless streets, the architecture unmistakably communist. Long uninterrupted takes, filmed at a distance from the action with a single camera, convey the impression that this film is of another era, composed much like a state-controlled television programme might have been. Realist cinematography roots the characters in the past for most of the film. It is only during the real-time filming of the talk show that the station's young cameraman, standing in for Porumboy, becomes involved in both the debate and the film itself. Framing the men in close-up, exposing their awkwardness, penetrating their truthfulness and remorse, he finally injects a touch of modernity into the reminiscences of the past. 1208 East of Bucharest is undeniably an esoteric film that will appeal to a small but avid film-going audience. A perfect example of Eastern European art house cinema, it offers an intelligent reflection on the nature of memory and the collapse of communism in a small Romanian town.
1208 East of Bucharest was released on the 17th of August and is still showing at the Renoir in Brunswick Square in London. The other film that Kim saw this month was Nacido y Criado, Born and Bred, released on the 24th of August.
I understood that it had been up for a lot of awards, so I didn't know that much about it. I didn't read the blurb that came with it deliberately, so I'd watch it from fresh, which is, unfortunately, I can't give you the advantage of not telling you about the film, because it would be a really dumb review. But I didn't know what to expect, and so I started watching this film, and I was, first of all, first thing that struck me was the texture. And my the first few moments I was watching it, I thought, this looks really cheap, and it looks really a bit grotty, and there's digital artifacts and digital graininess. And as I got used to it, I thought, well, actually, it's got a certain something to it, which if you watch 16mm, you get used to the graininess of that, and it starts to bring on a character of its own, in the same way that, you know, if you listen to music, you listen to something on vinyl, the crackle and the pop starts to become quite a part of the music and part of the experience, and this starts to get its own feel to the film. And it's quite harrowing at first, where this family is torn apart by a tragedy, and then you plunged into this world in Patagonia. And I have to say, I was rather bewildered by the fact that this family has this terrible accident in a Rover, which I was just thinking, you're driving a Rover 200 in South America. How did it get there? Which it says more about my strange perception of what goes on in movies. I judge a lot by the cars they drive, and it's a Rover 200. It's never going to survive. And then suddenly the lead character is working on an airfield in Patagonia. Now, I happen to know a little about Patagonia because I'm Welsh, and a certain band of Welsh people settled in Patagonia. It's a little part called Welsh Patagonia where they speak Welsh. So yeah, you know, well done the Welsh people, my fellow countrymen, for settling in the most inhospitable and cold, windy and difficult to live in parts of the world. Yeah, well done. You could have settled in California, but no, you had to go where it was really grotty, where it reminded you of South Wales. Thank you for that. But yes, Patagonia has a part in the place in the hearts of every Welsh person, because they think it's the only place we settled, and it lives up to all of its expectations. It's bleak and cold and beautiful and alluring, and the way the lots of films that are set in Sweden or anywhere which seems to push us away, I suppose that's part of it, is this guy blames himself for the tragedy that befell his family, and he just throws himself into work in an isolated environment where it's very much hand-to-mouth existence in an airfield, where when they have three people flying through, it's considered a good day. In fact, it's a good day if the airplane flight stops at all. You know, and I like the fact they make announcements. When there are three people there, they still go on the tannoy and announce it. And the characters are really deep and rich, and you get a chance to actually see them and react and interact in different circumstances. And the cold, harsh existence. Again, like Transylvania, this is life on the edge of the world. It's about as far as you can go before you drop off, literally, a continent. And it has that feel to it. The light is of a certain characteristic. The film suits the very bleak surroundings. And this guy's kind of trying to come to terms, trying to work out what's happened to him and what, if anything, he can do. And he's rejecting his life. And people go through situations. And again, the thing I like about it is the fact these people are dealing with very difficult situations, but they do it. They manage to. They deal with death and they deal with loss, and somehow they just get on and do it, because we have to do that as human beings. And it's how we do it which is interesting. I think when we fail, that doesn't make, to me, an interesting film or interesting piece of art in any way, to show somebody's failure to deal with the world around them. What's far more interesting is the coping mechanisms that people develop, and they're often humour, and sometimes violence, sometimes aggression, sometimes excess. And this film does have those. It does have some explosions of raw emotion and some scenes of excess, and it's going to. But all presented really well. And I have to say, the cast in it were superb. The guy who played Robert, Federico Esquero, was standout. But especially Thomas Lipan, who played Sasik. And I didn't get a lot of the references. They talk about certain names, you know, why you're called Sasik, and I don't know why that has a certain, why someone wouldn't be called Sasik. It seems as unusual to me as any other name that appears in the film, so I miss out on certain cultural references, but it doesn't affect the film. But I was blown away by it. I thought that it was wonderful that you could get a film that was set in such a strange place. But I don't know, I think fundamentally it could have been set anywhere, which you would take yourself to get away from your comfortable, easy middle class existence with a home help and a nice car and a beautiful wife and a happy child and a good business, and how you then punish yourself, how you take yourself away, how you remove yourself. So I think the setting was, and I did read the blurb afterwards, and I think it made a little bit too much of the fact that this was a South American film. And in fact, it's an international film, and that's what's great about both the films, is that it doesn't actually matter to the story where they're set. It enriches it. It makes it much more interesting to watch. And for us in England, it's a very, very exciting film to watch because it's a completely different world. But fundamentally, it wouldn't matter where it's set because it still has that texture, depth, and richness, and it follows a progression and gets to where it's going and takes you with it.
Born and Bred was released on the 24th of August and is currently showing at the BFI South Bank.
Hallam Foe released on August 31st. Both thriller and comedy, Hallam Foe is an enticing coming-of-age film about love, grief, and redemption. Directed by David McKenzie, who made Young Adam, and based on the novel by Peter Jinks, it's dominated by Jamie Bell's exciting performance as the title character, a screwed-up teenager addicted to voyeurism. Grieving over the mysterious death of his mother, Hallam is an almost feral creature, hunting his prey on the family estate in Scotland. Rejecting the luxury of his stately home, he lives instead in a treehouse, surrounded by his mother's photos, clothes, even her makeup. Obsessed by sex, he compulsively spies on his family and neighbours, furiously detailing his observations in a diary. His father, Kieran Hines, has remarried after his wife's death. His new bride and former secretary, Claire Forlani, is a gorgeous, enigmatic temptress. Shamed by an erotic encounter with her, Hallam flees his home for anonymity in Edinburgh, where fate leads him to Kate, Sophia Miles, a woman who looks almost identical to his mother. He soon charms her into offering him a job as a kitchen porter at the hotel where she works. Hallam takes to life on Edinburgh's stunning rooftops, spying on Kate in her home, piecing together the minutiae of her personal life, desperate to be near her. A humorous current runs through the film, from the opening credits, animated by the much-loved off-kilter illustrator David Shrigley, through to the very end. At its heart, Hallam Foe is something of a thriller. Echoes of Hitchcock permeate the film's style and narrative. In Edinburgh, Hallam's pursuit of Kate and her blonde hair pulled back tightly recall Kim Novak in Vertigo. So too do the vertiginous views of the city as Hallam clambers over the slate rooftops to spy on her. There is also something Rear Window-like in his insatiable voyeurism. Not physically bound in a wheelchair as Jimmy Stewart is, he's handicapped instead by his grief. Spying on other people is Hallam's way of escape, of submerging his pain over the loss of his mother. But it's also an addiction that spirals out of control. Seeing only fragments of the big picture, Hallam, like Stewart, comes to suspect that a murder's been committed. The suspicion that his stepmother might be involved in his mother's death becomes an obsession, tormenting him until he has no choice but to act. The film unravels, like Hitchcock's movies, as part mystery, part thriller, and part romance. The claustrophobic camera work forces us to see through Hallam's eyes. On the family estate, sweeping views of the Highlands are almost conspicuous by their absence. Rather, Hallam's world is close up and uncompromising. Writhing, naked bodies are seen through an entangled web of trees. The glassy lake where Hallam's mother drowned dominates the field of vision, forcing Hallam and the audience to confront the mystery of her death. We see Kate as Hallam sees her, framed by windows, seen through binoculars. But instead of making us feel alienated by Hallam's behaviour, McKenzie compels us to share in his pain and desire. Though Hallam's voyeurism is pathological, his violation of privacy frightening and disturbing, Bell imbues his character with a humour and wit that makes him both charming and vulnerable, even innocent. He's an outsider, just a teenager trying to fit in. While Bell so thoroughly dominates the core of the film, the characters on the periphery somewhat languish in their supporting roles. The women are especially two-dimensional and come perilously close to serving as little more than the mother-sister hall triptych, all too often found in popular culture. Hallam's devotion to his own mother borders on the religious, while the villainous stepmother uses sex to manipulate both Hallam and his father to achieve her own ends. Kate is both enigmatic and vulnerable, an object of desire who is characterised by her affair with a married man and her vampish attitude towards sex. Though Hallam's relationship with her is central to the film, her character is never really fleshed out. Would he fall in love with her if she didn't resemble his mother? It's a shame that the female roles aren't stronger and more complex, but it's a common fault and one that McKenzie is also guilty of in Young Adam. Though the film celebrates Edinburgh, this is one British film that is not trying to earn its success by being a tourist promotion for the UK, unlike the objectionable Notting Hill or even Woody Allen's Matchpoint, which pandered to American audiences by creating a false, idealised view of Britain. Instead, Hallam Foe is a touching, funny and intelligent portrayal of a teenager stumbling through his grief in the cold, inhospitable climate of a grey country.
Hallam Foe is released on the 31st of August and is showing at the View Cinema West End and in cinemas nationwide. The Arthouse Cinema podcast was written and edited by Alex Fitch, with reviews written by Kim Morgan and Sarah Cronin, presented by Alex Kim and Virginie Selavy, and is a Resonance FM production.